Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. I'm very pleased to be able to present to you a man that I admire tremendously, both for his deep knowledge of the main thing, as our friend Jim Fennell calls it, the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it represents, but also for the compassion that he brings to his discussion of the subject, born, I think, of some considerable experience at a formative time in his life in China, witnessing firsthand the nature of the regime and its barbarism towards its own people. His name is Stephen Mosher. He is the founder and president of a very important organization, the Population Research Institute. He's the author of a number of books, including Bully of Asia, which amply describes what we're dealing with in the Chinese Communist Party. He's also more recently written about pandemics and what we need to know about that. And we'll talk with him a little bit about all of it in the course of these two segments. Steve Mosher, it's good to have you back. You are a valued member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, among other things, and we're especially anxious to pick your brain about what's going on in China with respect to the Chinese Communist Party in particular. Good to have you, sir.
Good to be with you, Brian.
So we did a webinar the other day of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, as you may know, Steve, focused in on the crisis that seems suddenly to be besetting the Chinese Communist Party. And I know you wrote recently in the New York Post about one particular aspect of that crisis, namely the demographic disaster that they have wrought with their one-child policy. But put it into the larger context, if you would. An economic crisis seems to be very much upon them, and a political one too, perhaps.
Well, there certainly is a crisis, a multidimensional crisis in China today. Now, I firmly believe, and I think you probably share this belief, that communism always and everywhere eventually collapses from its internal contradictions, although the timing of the collapse is open to speculation. I think we're approaching that point in China today, and I say that because we have an unsustainable economic model here in China. Which is in the middle of a giant Ponzi scheme, which is in the middle of collapsing as we speak, and there's no better illustration of that collapse than the fact that China is now blowing up high-rise apartment buildings that were partially built but never occupied, and they have become white elephants, and is simply now destroying them with explosive charges. I think that's
a metaphor.
Clearly a metaphor for the way the Chinese Communist Party is destroying China's economy right now. Official corruption is rampant, and it's only going to further hinder the economy because Xi Jinping, who appears to be in crisis mode himself, has now said they're going to be tracing corruption back two decades in China, so that any official in a senior position in China now understands that unless he's as someone who's very close to Xi Jinping, he may very well be charged with corruption dating back to 2003. So that's fostered, I think, a lot of opposition to him within the senior ranks of the Chinese Communist Party. The mismanagement of the economy, the misallocation of resources, the crushing of creativity and innovation in the name of control. And of course, Xi Jinping is all about control all the time. The recklessly escalating debt. We worry about our debt here in the United States, but China has, compared to its GDP, two or three times the level of debt we have. Local governments in China are bankrupt and going bankrupt as we speak. Transportation is being shut down. Public transportation is being shut down in different cities because that service has been running at a deficit for years and it's unsustainable. The destruction of the environment is ongoing. 80-90% of the groundwater in China is undrinkable because of pollution. The air pollution, we all know, is horrible. So all those factors will contribute to the coming collapse and are coming together right now. But I think over the long term, the most intractable one, the one that will be the most difficult for China to deal with is the fact that they've eliminated half of the last two generations. They've eliminated 400 million people from their population, strangling, you know, the baby in the cradle, as it were, by forced abortion, forced sterilization, and infanticide. Recently, Xi Jinping, as the chairman of the Central Military Commission, issued what was tantamount to an order to the PLA that every member of the PLA should have at least three children. Now, that's an act of desperation, I believe. And of course, while he can order the military to do that, getting the vast numbers of the Chinese population to go along is going to be a much, much harder thing. The Chinese Communist Party has always treated the Chinese people as kind of an inexhaustible resource that they can squander at will, and they've squandered it again and again and again. But I'm sure that neither Deng Xiaoping nor Xi Jinping nor any other successor to Mao Zedong ever realized that the brutal one-child policy would result in the death of the China dream. But I believe that is now almost certain to happen.
Yeah, this is a very grim prospect indeed, across the board, as you say, Steve. One other element, which I don't think you mentioned, but that's also stunning, especially at a moment when China is, for reasons you've just described, beset with a population that's disproportionately aging. The youth of the country are grossly underemployed, mm-hmm. and all of this is doubtless creating the conditions for political ferment, if not, in fact, the overthrow of this regime. There are those in this country, Steve, I know you're not among them, and certainly our Committee on the Present Danger, China, is not, who think that our response to all of this should be to prop up the Chinese communists and Xi Jinping specifically. Your thoughts on that idea?
Well, I think that we've seen a whole parade of senior Biden officials going to China for what I consider to be job interviews. When you talk about Yellen, when you talk about Blinken, when you talk about Jake Sullivan meeting secretly on the island of Malta, with senior Chinese leaders. That, I think, is less about representing the interests of the United States than it is about thinking about their future employment after January 2025, when they're no longer so-called in public service. So I consider all those trips to be job interviews. They want a paper over.
In a sense, I think it's fair to say they're actually looking to return to serving the Chinese Communist Party.
Absolutely.
No?
Many of them have been receiving directly or indirectly subsidies from the Chinese Communist Party for a long time under the Chinese principle of elite capture. We all know about the Biden Center at Penn State and all of the other ways that the Chinese Communist Party funnels money to people in Washington who in turn support it by way of payment. So nothing is going on there except an effort to try to placate the Chinese Communist Party, and on the margins, help them to stay in power, which is not in the interest of the United States of America, certainly. I thought it also very interesting, Frank, that the Ministry of State Security is now getting involved in foreign policy issues in China. And why is that? Well, because Xi Jinping has effectively decapitated the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, removing a couple of senior officials because he didn't trust them, apparently, or they were involved in corruption scandals or scandals of another kind. And now it's the Ministry of State Security talking about whether or not Biden and Xi will meet in San Francisco in a few months. That's extraordinary. Why would the Ministry of Foreign Affairs be sidelined in favor of the intelligence service when it comes to talking about foreign policy issues? Well, I think in part because Xi Jinping doesn't trust anyone except for now his secret police. He's been removing senior military officers, generals in the PLA, left, right, and center.
Yeah, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Stephen Mosher, the author of Bully of Asia, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Senator Tommy Tuberville is an endangered species in official Washington. That's not because political hacks in uniform and out are taking every imaginable cheap shot at him, including that he's, quote, endangering our national security, unquote, by holding up the promotions of some 300 officers. Rather, what makes Coach Tuberville such a rarity is that he actually has sound principles and is willing to fight for them. Specifically, he believes the U.S. military is not an instrument for political warfare, but for the shooting kind. And Army Ranger veteran Will Tebow will tell Congress today that at least 42% of the 300 promotables have publicly supported the cultural Marxist makeover of our armed forces. For that reason alone, not a one of them should be promoted. And as long as it is up to the principled, patriotic Tommy Tuberville, they won't be. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are continuing a very important conversation with Stephen Mosier, the author of The Bully of Asia, a man who knows his way around the Chinese system by virtue of having spent in his relative youth, early on, it turns out, in the opening of China, some very critical time on the ground there, witnessing firsthand the nature of the regime and its brutal repression of its people. He has ever since been a harsh critic of its one-child policy, and I think is now witnessing the fruits of that policy wreaking havoc inside the Chinese population and for the political system that governs it. Steve, I did want to just offer one thought that it may be that the Ministry of State Security is running the foreign ministry for at least the purposes of a prospective meeting with Joe Biden, because as our friend Sam Faddis points out, Joe Biden is a controlled asset of the Ministry of State Security and the Chinese intelligence service. But I wanted to ask you a more important point. As you look at this crisis, and I think it's clearly a major crisis on these various levels, is it your expectation that the Chinese Communist Party will do what totalitarians often do in some circumstances like this, which is to say, try to change the subject, try to deflect attention, try to create a distraction from, or even a pretext for justifying the repression at home by claiming that there's some external threat that has to be countered? And especially, Steve, when you talk about this demographic crisis, and there are, by some estimates, 40 million military-aged men for whom there are no women in China because of that genocide against particularly female infants. Could that really be the case, that we're looking at a lot of cannon fodder being sent to fight a war that would perhaps be aimed at us?
Well, absolutely. And just to put the whole demographic situation in perspective, the Chinese Communist Party now says that the fertility rate in China is 1.09 children per woman over her reproductive lifetime. I think it's probably even a little lower than that, because the CCP are past masters of lying with statistics. And it may be coming down to the level of Hong Kong, which is 0.8 child per woman over a reproductive lifetime. They also claim their current population is 1.41 billion. I don't think so. I think their population is smaller. I think they're at about 1,280 million, because they lie with numbers. This discrepancy is 130 million. That's not a rounding error. That's a population number, 130 million, larger than all but nine countries in the world. So the demographic dividend that in the 80s and 90s and early years of this century supported China's rapid economic growth and military buildup and strategic expansion is gone. It's gone totally. And another way, people need to understand that by about 2060, the population of the United States may be, in fact, larger than that of China's. The demographic decline in China is occurring so very rapidly. By that time, of course, the population will be aging and dying. So what does the Communist Party do in this circumstance? Well, I think they lash out. I think they take some of the 40 million young men who will not be able to find brides, induct them into the military, and send them on foreign adventures, perhaps promised if they succeed in conquering Taiwan, they will all get brides as a reward. And it is true that you mentioned the youth unemployment rate. The official rate is 21%. I think it may be 30 or 40%, actually. And a lot of those young men, however, have now 10 million young men have signed up for military service because they have no other job prospects. And Xi Jinping has now increased the pay of military service members and the benefits of military service members so that military service is actually more attractive than working in the private sector in China today. So he's signing up millions of young men into the military. Why would he be doing that if not for the purpose of using them against Taiwan or using them against other contiguous countries to China to expand China's territory? So yeah, they're very, very concerning.
Especially when you combine it, as you say, with the despoiling of their own country. You know, there's this speech that's credited to Chiao Chen. I may not be pronouncing that properly, but a general who was the secretary, the minister of defense about 20 years ago to a close meeting of party cadre, I believe, in which he claimed that the biological warfare program of communist China, illegal at that, had been commissioned by Deng Xiaoping, the then general secretary of the CCP, to depopulate the United States so it could be colonized by China. Given what they've done, given the desperate straits they're in, given this need to divert attention and so on, Steve, do you think that's in prospect for us?
Oh, I think China is using all kinds of warfare tactics against us right now, from fentanyl, killing 100,000 Americans a year. And I was recently reminded that, you know, one of the reasons that we failed in Vietnam was because North Vietnam in about 1970 began sending vast amounts of opium south. Instead of guerrillas carrying rifles, there were guerrillas carrying packets of opium that they were selling to American soldiers, and that in some units, 40 or 50% of the soldiers were addicted to opium, and that greatly hindered our war effort. I think that China is adopting the North Vietnamese model vis-a-vis the United States right now and attacking us with a chemical weapon. Would they attack us with a biological weapon? Sure, they did already with COVID-19. They'll certainly do it again when they have something they think will be effective and a means of delivering it. And I do not think that China's nuclear buildup nuclear stockpile is being rapidly expanded just to sit in the nose cones of warheads buried in the ground. I think that they do contemplate using them in the event of a conflict over Taiwan. Certainly, they've already threatened to do that against Japan if they intervene in a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And would they hesitate to use them on the American mainland? I don't think so. 20 years ago, they were already publishing maps showing the tens of millions of Americans they could kill by hitting the cities, major cities on the west coast of the United States. And their ICBMs can now reach all of the United States.
Steve, I will be talking more with Peter Husey shortly about the nuclear threat. But just to drill down on one aspect of this, there are those who believe, as I do, that the Chinese Communist Party does, in fact, intend to go to war with us, not just Taiwan, but us as well as perhaps others in the region. The question of timing, there are those who say they will wait until after the Taiwanese election to see whether they may be able to take the island without fighting by virtue of the election of a guy who will work with them to that end. I had a conversation yesterday with John Mills about the likelihood that they'll wait until this new third carrier is ready for combat. Do you have any sense of how imminent this may be?
Well, I think in part it depends on the climate. The Taiwan Straits, the waters in the Taiwan Straits are fairly choppy in the winter and late summer with typhoon season. So their invasion window is really late spring and early summer, which means that they've missed it this year, unless they want to risk all of their troop transports. And many of those will be car ferries, which cannot, you know, traverse the Taiwan Straits during high winds and high waves. So I'm thinking next year. While Biden is still in office, while he is so compromised that who knows what he would do in the event of a conflict, any hesitation would be fatal, of course, to Taiwan's success in repelling an invasion.
Yeah, and I would argue probably to us as well. Steve Mosher, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time, sir, and your great expertise. It's a privilege to be able to talk to you. We look forward to doing so again soon. Talk to you. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and welcome to a first-time guest. His name is Brandon Trusclair. He is a businessman down in Louisiana, where he runs a chain of grocery stores. He has achieved some national prominence for having successfully sued over vaccine mandates on his employees, sparing them and I think the rest of us the jab, and we're very grateful for that. These days he's running for the job of Secretary of State in his native state of Louisiana, and has been giving a lot of thought to and is in fact campaigning on the basis of election integrity and some important changes that are needed with respect to voting machines and processes, both in Louisiana and more generally. Brandon, it's very good to have you with us, sir. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mr. Frank. Pleasure to be here.
So, first of all, level set for us on the state of election integrity in your state of Louisiana at the moment.
Mr. Frank, I think the elections here in Louisiana are just flat out awful. What all of our politicians are going around saying, and our state department's going around saying, is that, hey, the Heritage Foundation, on that call-in survey, they said we're the six best elections in the country. And the fact of the matter is, we're the only state in the country where you can't audit our elections. That call-in survey by the Heritage Foundation also gives us an F in the accuracy of our voter rolls, F in proof of citizenship, F in voter ID, and I can go on and on and on. But that is unacceptable to me, and it should be unacceptable to the people of Louisiana. There's absolutely no accountability and no transparency at all. We outsource our vote, and we outsource our registration, and it's really, it's quite honestly, it's shameful to the people of Louisiana.
So I understand there are two particular problems. One is the number of people who are on the voter rolls who should not be.
Correct.
And some problems that have already been documented with the election machinery, physical hardware as well. Is that right?
Yeah, there's actually three big issues that I'm focusing on. Number one, as you mentioned, is the machine. So we outsource our vote counting to a third-party vendor with proprietary software. I know when I went to mathematics, to LSU as a mathematics major, they never told me addition was proprietary. But apparently when it's counting votes, it's proprietary. Nobody in authority has permission to look into that proprietary software. That's problem number one. Problem number two, as I stated in our Louisiana legislative audit report, it says that we don't audit our elections, nor do we even have the ability to audit our elections. That makes us the only state in the country that we don't audit our elections. That's problem number two. Problem number three, I mentioned the Heritage Foundation says we have F in the accuracy of our voter rolls. Well, what that leads to, we outsource our registration, and that leads to 700,000 people, Mr. Frank, 700,000 people. It's one in five Louisianians are inactive and ineligible and shouldn't be on our voter rolls according to the current law that's on the books right now. That's unacceptable.
700,000 out of an electorate of what size?
Yeah, 1.9 million registered voters here in Louisiana.
Wow.
Yep. Pretty sad.
That's kind of a problem. So you also mentioned voter ID. Does your state not require voter ID?
Yeah. So it does require voter ID here, but the implementation of voter ID, according to the Heritage Foundation, it gives us an F in voter ID. So you have proprietary software machines, you have an F in voter ID, and you have dirty voter rolls. It's just a recipe for disaster,
I'll say. So you're running for the job of Secretary of State, which would give you, presumably, the authority to make changes. Talk a little bit about what kind of changes you would contemplate if you had the job.
Yeah, so first off, under Act 480, which was passed a couple of years ago here in Louisiana, we have a top-down system here, so the Secretary of State makes the decisions for the entire state. All in one go. It won't be piecemeal together like other states, but we have the authority to use paper ballots. And so the first thing that I'm going to do as the next Secretary of State is I'm going to clean up our registration rolls, and I'm going to keep them clean. I'm going to get rid of these outdated technology voting machines that are proprietary. We're going to use a hand count, secure paper ballot. And then for the first time in decades and decades, if ever, the people of Louisiana will be able to audit their own elections. They won't have to ask for them. They won't have to pay for it. They won't have to file a FOIA request. We're going to give it to them within 24 hours of an election. We're going to upload an image of every single ballot, and they can count their own precincts, their own parish, or the whole doggone state if they wanted to. But at the end of the day, it's all about giving accountability and transparency to we the people.
I've been told that the only way you can really do this is to do it at the precinct level, that is just otherwise such a volume of ballots and work that it's untenable. Is that your assessment, and is that how you would plan on doing hand counting of paper ballots?
Absolutely, Mr. Frank. We've been working with Patriots all across the country in Florida, Texas, Arkansas, Missouri, and what we've really worked close with was Miss Linda Rance in Missouri. We've kind of adopted their method. We've made some fine-tuned changes to it, but when we've practiced over and over and over again, we're going to be counting at the precinct level, and we will be able to give a certified election counted by the people of Louisiana within minutes of the polls closing. That's what we know we can do. That's what, again, they're doing in Missouri already. So we're going to be able to give them a certified hand count election by the people of Louisiana within minutes of the polls closing.
This is enormously heartening. Talk quickly, if you would, about cleaning up the voter rolls. What do you have in mind in that regard, and do you have the mechanical capability to do it?
It's quite simple, Mr. Frank. It's very, very simple. Just follow the law. I don't need new legislation. We don't need new laws. We just need to follow the laws that are already on the books. You know, we have people that are registered at UPS stores and FedEx shops. That's against the law. We have people that are 143 years old registered to vote here in Louisiana still. The Constitution of Louisiana is very clear that the Secretary of State shall keep the voter rolls clean. It's very clear and says that the registrar of voters should physically canvass their parishes, and they're not. So we're going to be working with the registrar of voters to do just that, to physically canvass, and we're going to clean up these voter rolls, and we're going to keep them clean. It's a very easy process. It just needs to be done.
Yeah. You know, I have in the past interviewed a fellow by the name of Jay Valentine. I don't know if this is a name you know or not, but he has, as sort of a profession, been a professional fraud buster. And one of his recent lines of work has been having the capability, basically within seconds, to assess voter rolls and ferret out those names that are clearly problematic. So I would recommend touching base with him, and perhaps he can give you a hand with all this. So the question that I guess arises inevitably, Brandon Dusclair, is all of this sounds really good and really necessary, but can you get elected if those kinds of reforms have not been put into place for your own election?
We absolutely can get elected, and we're certainly running to win. I announced my campaign back in November that I was running, and we were the only person in the race. Our Secretary of State dropped out of this race back in April, and since then we've had seven other politicians jump in. And the good news, Mr. Frank, is that they all say that life is good here in Louisiana. There's nothing to see. We have great elections, and there's one candidate that says we have a problem, and we're going to give a solution to fix those problems. And so the people of Louisiana understand that. They get that. Everywhere we go, we're getting great response and great feedback. We're going to be making our 152nd stop across Louisiana today. We're traveling up to Shreveport, and we're getting great response. 68% of Americans don't trust their elections. And the reason that is, Mr. Frank, because there is no accountability and no transparency. And I can tell you the people of Louisiana have had enough, and they're fed up. And luckily for them, there's one candidate that's going to clean it up and be accountable and transparent to the people. So they have a choice, and we are running to win.
And as I understand it, you're the one candidate that isn't a professional politician. Is that right? That's correct. Do you think that might have some correlation to the fact think it's everything's good with the elections? They've gotten elected?
Well, the correlation is they quite frankly, they don't know what they're talking about when it comes to elections here in Louisiana. They're just reading about this Heritage Foundation says we're, you know, top 10 elections, and that's all they know. They've never heard of the Haldeman Report. They never read the Louisiana Legislative Audit Report. They don't know about anything to do with these machines that they're proprietary. I mean, common sense says you can't. I mean, why is our voting proprietary, vote counting proprietary? They just don't know what they're talking about. So.
You know, I haven't studied the Heritage Report, I must say, but it sounds a little odd that you had Fs in at least two categories, as I recall, and you nonetheless came out sixth. I guess that's an indictment of the rest of the country's record, that they're even worse in more categories than you. Is that right?
Yeah. There's at least an F in at least three categories, three of the probably of the dozen or so out there. Look, I interned in the Heritage Foundation as a young man many, many moons ago, and we've reached out to them and say, hey, this can't be right. You know, this call-in survey, we got a 75 on. We can't be, better than, or Georgia's better than us. I mean, come on, give me a break. So something's not going on here. We've reached out to them to correct it, haven't heard back, but nonetheless, we campaign telling people of Louisiana what the facts are, and they agreed with us. Mm.
Well, Hans von Spakovsky, I imagine, has something to do with the study, and he's a good friend. And I'll be happy to give him a ring about this, too, because I know he's all about, the Heritage Foundation more generally, is all about election integrity. And
yeah, we'll help
heavens
us
knows we need it.
Yeah, help us touch base with each other. Of course, you can reach me at letsgobrandon.net. Of course, that's the Cajun way, GEAUX, letsgobrandon.net.
Let's go, Brandon. I love that. Thank you, Brandon. It is encouraging to see people getting into the arena because they see a serious problem that they may be able to help fix. And I hope this will turn out to be a model not only for corrective action in your own state, but across the country. Good luck to you. Stay in touch. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Senator Tommy Tuberville is an endangered species in official Washington. That's not because political hacks in uniform and out are taking every imaginable cheap shot at him, including that he's, quote, endangering our national security, unquote, by holding up the promotions of some 300 officers. Rather, what makes Coach Tuberville such a rarity is that he actually has sound principles and is willing to fight for them. Specifically, he believes the U.S. military is not an instrument for political warfare, but for the shooting kind. And Army Ranger veteran Will Tebow will tell Congress today that at least 42% of the 300 promotables have publicly supported the cultural Marxist makeover of our armed forces. For that reason alone, not a one of them should be promoted. And as long as it is up to the principled, patriotic Tommy Tuberville, they won't be. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and we are joined by Peter Husey, the president of Geostrategic Analysis, a consultancy that he has operated, among other things, in the Washington, D.C. area for quite some time. Man of considerable experience in government, but also with various think tanks and educational centers, where he has focused laser-like on issues of deterrence, war and peace, the national security of the United States. And he's talked a lot of the rest of us about all of those matters. We're always delighted to catch up with him. Peter, welcome back.
And thank you, Frank. Thank you very, very much. Always an honor to come in and talk to you.
Thank you. Let me start by picking up on a topic that we discussed earlier in the program with Stephen Mosier, which is the prospect that the Chinese Communist Party is now in sufficient difficulty that it may decide to use as kind of a safety valve internally external aggression. And the possibility, according to Steve, that they haven't built all those nuclear weapons that suddenly seem to be piling up in China for nothing, that this may in fact result in them actually using nuclear weapons, perhaps against us as well as others. Your thoughts, sir, about that possibility? Give us a little bit of a sense of what kind of buildup has been going on there.
Well, thank you, Frank. The Chinese have more ICBM launchers than we do, in excess of probably 450 or so. They're also building probably upwards of six new Boomer submarines with the JL-3 missile, which is now a MIRV, multiple warhead missile, and they're building a strategic bomber force. Their bomber air force is the third largest in the world, and they have 350 ship Navy, which exceeds that of the United States, though not in terms of capability yet. They're building a strong competitive nuclear capability in order to dissuade, coerce, and blackmail the United States not to interfere with their business. So it's not that they want to exchange warheads blowing up Shanghai for New York. They just don't want us in the business. They don't want us in their knickers, okay? Now, that doesn't mean they wouldn't, as Putin has threatened, to use a limited number of nuclear weapons in a conflict where they think we'll stand down as a result of such a threat. So to me, what they're building is, and Admiral Richard and General Cotton, our current and just previous STRAC commander, have said they want a coercive nuclear capability, meaning be able to tell us, stand down. That's very important.
And they are certainly in the process of building the capability, if they want to go beyond that, to actually exercise a massive thermonuclear destruction option. But Peter, I wanted to ask you about one aspect of this that we again discussed a little bit with Steve Mosher, which is the idea that has been apparently operating in senior Chinese Communist Party circles going back to Deng Xiaoping's time, that they want to actually depopulate the United States so that it can be colonized by China, rather than lay waste to it, as they've done effectively in their own territory. Talk us through the possibility that what they may in fact be thinking about is not a nuclear attack, but as you say, a coercive approach, but that they will be using biological weapons for the depopulation purpose, and thereby, you know, having a country that is still reasonably clean and you know, susceptible to being exploited by them in the future.
Well, there are a number of things, Frank, that they might do. One would be an EMP attack, which, as former Speaker of the House Gingrich has pointed out, would put us back sometime in the beginning of the 19th century in terms of capability. You're talking about 30, 40 million people surviving. On the other hand, a biological weapon like the exercise we did at the National Defense University years ago about what's called Dark Winter was what would happen if they released smallpox. Well, 60 million Americans died within a matter of, I think, 3 months. So China's writings are that they're at war with us now, and they're at war with us across the board. There's no area, whether economics, politics, diplomacy, or military, that they're not at war with us. And they see, and they do want to supplant us as the world's leader, call it the world's hegemon. And you are right. They have written fairly explicitly about taking down our society. And an EMP attack, for example, would so cripple us and so paralyze us, we would probably not be able to respond to any threat overseas. So that, to me, would be step one. Once they turn us into basically what they consider a third world power, they might be able to colonize us. I mean, you wonder, are they really going to try do this? And my view is, I've been studying Chinese history and China foreign policy since I lived in Korea and went to school there. And that was 1969 and 70. So yes, you're right. And it is, and Steve Mosher, God love him, he's been trying to get us to wake up. And if you look at Mike Pillsbury's book, the 100-year marathon, the Chinese are primarily going to do this economically, but that means destroying our economy first.
Yeah. Well, again, I keep thinking that what they want is to have the infrastructure intact as much as possible so that it can be exploited.
Yeah, they can restore the grid. They can restore a lot of things. But I don't disagree with you, Frank. These are very serious people. And the fact that, as one Morton congressman said the other day, he said, the fact that they're evil doesn't mean they don't have smart people who know what they're up to.
Yeah. The combination of smart and evil people is very, very problematic, needless to say. Peter, we have to take a short break in a moment, but I want, as you've made a life's work of thinking about the unthinkable, as they say, and specifically thinking about how do you deter the unthinkable from taking place, whether it's a cataclysmic nuclear attack or something along the lines of what we've just been discussing, an electromagnetic pulse that destroys our electric grid and thereby the most critical of our critical infrastructures, or, you know, a biological attack that wipes out our population. How do we prevent that from happening, and how far short of doing that are we? That's the topic that we will turn to with Peter Husey of Geostrategic Analysis on the other side of a very short break. I encourage you to stay tuned because you have a need to know. I'll be right back. We're back, and we are continuing a conversation that is troubling, to be sure, but very, very important, certainly very timely, especially in light of what we were discussing earlier in the program with Steve Mosher about the real prospects of a shooting war with the Chinese Communist Party. Our guest is Peter Husey, the president of Geostrategic Analysis, a man who has given a lot of thought over a lifetime about the nature of deterrence in a variety of settings with variety of adversaries. But in particular, we need to be thinking very hard about what is required to prevent the Chinese Communist Party, perhaps in combination with their junior partner in their No Limits partnership, Vladimir Putin's Russia, from going to war, whether at a nuclear level or otherwise. And Peter, you had a recent piece in Warrior Maven entitled, "What Does the Pentagon Truly Need for Nuclear Deterrence to Stop Russia and China?" Give us kind of the short form of your thinking on that very important question.
Okay, what I did is I went back and got a lot of the testimony and writings of former Strat Commander Admiral Richard, and also that of the current Strat Commander General Cotton, both of whom I admire enormously and are really extraordinary people. The most important point in Admiral Richard's make is it's not a nuclear deterrent. The issue is not what, it's when. And he says, I don't have what I need now, given on what's going on in the future. So we're modernizing, but we have no room for delay, and we have no room for error, and we have no, you know, there's no give in the system. But most importantly, he said, none of our conventional plans work if the other guy introduces nuclear weapons. And what he was testifying about, which is what I based the article on, he was saying, I need not only a strong conventional capability, but there are gaps in the nuclear capability that unless I fix them, Russia and China are going to try to take advantage of that. And the most important thing is the low yield, short range, regional, what are called theater nuclear weapons. And there, the sea launch cruise missile, which we had, and then we took it and put it in storage. And then unfortunately, we got rid of them. It's called Slick'em N, is the fancy word. We desperately need that because we don't have anything except for gravity bombs on fighter planes in Europe, and somewhere in 100 or so. And Russia has thousands of these things. And China, as far as I know, Frank, also has thousands of these things, possibly. I don't know, because they're nothing transparent about the Chinese nuclear forces, unfortunately. So that is the number one issue. And what's interesting, guess what would help solve that, not only with Slick'em, is missile defense, particularly air and missile defense, especially against cruise missiles, and especially against cruise missiles that are hypersonic in capability. So those areas we're now working on to get missile defense. The House and Senate completely changed the language now and said, we're looking at missile defense as stabilizing and helping deterrence, as opposed to the traditional view is, well, we don't have too much because it'll upset Russia and China. My view is, I want as many defenses I can build, and if it upsets Russia and China, well, too bad. I don't want to give them a free hit, a free strike at us.
Peter, you and I go back a long ways in all of this, from the time where it was impermissible for us to have any missile defense. We got ourselves finally out from under the anti-ballistic missile treaty that essentially rendered us defenseless. Thanks to George W. Bush, to his credit. And as you say, we adopted this posture which said, well, we can have a limited defense principally against North Korea and Iran.
Exactly.
But we can't have one to deal with the Russian or the Chinese threats. And you're saying that now it appears that it's become apparent that we do, in fact, need to complicate the attack planning of these Russians and Chinese targeteers, and that we are now cleared under the Biden administration to build a missile defense that's more comprehensive?
It's in the bills, the defense bills that have passed the House and Senate.
So the Congress is taking that position. How about the administration?
The administration made a slight gesture in that area saying, we have to think about this. They're not crazy about missile defense, but they're better than historically where the pro-ABM treaty people have been. And they're beginning to understand that if you're talking about limited number of use of these weapons, nuclear weapons, well, missile defense becomes extraordinarily valuable because I don't need to shoot down 1,000. If I can shoot down a couple dozen, I give the bad guy an option. You can go all the way to the top and what Paul Nitze called the Armageddon option, or nothing. You know, keep the gun in the holster.
When it goes back to that point that I made that about, you know, complicating their attack planning, that's of great value. You mentioned Paul Nitze, who had this idea that, you know, we had to have this marginal advantage in terms of the cost of defense versus offense. I think
my view is, what's the value of New York City? Okay, how do you calculate that? And I think, Frank, the most important thing is, as General Cotton and Admiral Richards have said, John Kennedy stopped the Cuban Missile Crisis from going bad by having options that the Soviets did not have. And they're very explicit about that. And part of it was the Minuteman missile was deployed the very day that John Kennedy announced, we found missiles, Russian Soviet missiles in Cuba. And he said later on when he went out to Lawrence Livermore to talk about this, he said, Minuteman was my ace in the hole that enabled me to stare down Khrushchev.
And the point, Peter, that I think we need to be very much mindful of is today, and I think this goes to the heart of your recommendations here, the Russians and the Chinese have options that we don't have, thanks to our having essentially failed to modernize our strategic arsenal and tactical
for four decades.
Exactly. Peter, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a topic to which we will return though soon, as both the need to enhance our deterrent posture and how best to do that are topics that are, I think, vitally important to our country, and we appreciate your leadership in explaining them. I have to say goodbye. We are done. Okay. Hard out of time. Come back and save the rest of it soon.
Always a privilege.
I hope the rest of you will be with us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.